Belinda presents this unabridged recording of Truly, Madly, Guilty, written by Leanne Moriarty and read by Caroline Lee. The dedication reads, "For Jackie." Music is the silence between the notes. Claude Debussy. Chapter 1. "This is a story that begins with a barbecue," said Clementine. The microphone amplified and smoothed her voice, making it more authoritative, as if it had been photoshopped. An ordinary neighborhood barbecue in an ordinary backyard. Well, not exactly an ordinary backyard, thought Erica. She crossed her legs, tucked one foot behind her ankle, and sniffed. Nobody would call Vid's backyard ordinary. Erica sat in the middle of the back row of the audience in the event room that adjoined this smartly renovated local library in a suburb 45 minutes out of the city, not 30 minutes, thank you very much, as suggested by the person at the cab company, who you would think would have some sort of expertise in the matter. There were maybe 20 people in the audience, although there were fold-out chairs available for twice that many. Most of the audience were elderly people with lively, expectant faces. These were intelligent, informed senior citizens who had come along on this rainy, yet again would it ever end, morning to collect new and fascinating information at their local community matters meeting. "I saw the most interesting woman speak today," they wanted to tell their children and grandchildren. Before she came, Erica had looked up the library's website to see how it described Clementine's talk. The blurb was short and not very informative. "Here, Sydney mother and well-known cellist Clementine Hart share her story, One Ordinary Day." Was Clementine really a well-known cellist? That seemed a stretch. The $5 fee for today's event included two guest speakers, a delicious homemade morning tea, and the chance to win a lucky door prize. The speaker after Clementine was going to talk about the council's controversial redevelopment plan for the local pool. Erica could hear the distant, gentle clatter of cups and saucers being set up for the morning tea now. She held her flimsy raffle ticket for the lucky door prize safely on her lap. She couldn't be bothered putting it in her bag and then having to find it when they drew the raffle. Blue E24. It didn't have the look of a winning ticket. The lady who sat directly in front of Erica had her grey, curly-haired head tipped to one side in a sympathetic, engaged manner, as if she were ready to agree with everything Clementine had to say. The tag on her shirt was sticking up. Size 12, Target. Erica reached over and slid it back down. The lady turned her head. "Tag," whispered Erica. The lady smiled her thanks, and Erica watched the back of her neck turn pale pink. The younger man sitting next to her, her son perhaps, who looked to be in his 40s, had a barcode tattooed on the back of his tanned neck, as if he were a supermarket product. Was it meant to be funny? Ironic? Symbolic? Erica wanted to tell him that it was, in point of fact, idiotic. "It was just an ordinary Sunday afternoon," said Clementine. Noticeable repetition of the word ordinary. Clementine must have decided that it was important she appear relatable to these ordinary people in the ordinary outer suburbs. Erica imagined Clementine sitting at her small dining room table, or maybe at Sam's unrestored antique desk, in her shabby chic sandstone terrace house with its water glimpse, writing her little community-minded speech while she chewed on the end of her pen and pulled all that lavish dark hair of hers over one shoulder to caress in that sensual, slightly self-satisfied way she had, as if she were Rapunzel, thinking to herself, "Ordinary." "Indeed, Clementine, how shall you make the ordinary people understand?" "It was early winter, a cold, gloomy day," said Clementine. "What the—" Erica shifted in her chair. "It had been a beautiful day. A magnificent day." That was the word Vid had used. "Or possibly glorious. A word like that, anyway." "There was a real bite in the air," said Clementine. And she actually shivered theatrically, and surely unnecessarily, when it was warm in the room, so much so that a man sitting a few rows in front of Erica appeared to have nodded off. He had his legs stretched out in front of him and his hands clasped comfortably across his stomach, his head tipped back as if he were napping on an invisible pillow. Perhaps he'd died. Maybe the day of the barbecue had been cool, but it was definitely not gloomy. Erica knew that eyewitness accounts were notoriously unreliable because people thought they just pressed rewind on the little recorder installed in their heads, when in fact they constructed their memories. They developed their own narratives. And so when Clementine remembered the barbecue, she remembered a cold, gloomy day. But Clementine was wrong. Erica remembered. She remembered. She was absolutely not constructing how on the morning of the barbecue, Vid had bent down to lean into her car window. "Isn't it a magnificent day?" he'd said. Erica knew for an absolute fact that was what he'd said. Or it may have been glorious. But it was a word with positive connotations. She could be sure of that. If only Erica had said, "Yes, Vid, it certainly is a magnificent slash glorious day," and put her foot back on the accelerator. "I remember I dressed my little girls extra warmly," said Clementine. "Sam probably dressed the girls," thought Erica. Clementine cleared her throat and gripped the sides of the lectern with both hands. The microphone was angled too high for her, so it seemed as though she were on tippy toes, trying to get her mouth close enough. Her neck was elongated, emphasizing the new skinniness of her face. Erica considered the possibility of discreetly edging her way around the side of the room and zipping over to adjust the microphone. It would only take a second. She imagined Clementine shooting her a grateful smile. "Thank God you did that," she would say afterwards, while they had coffee. "You really saved the day." Except that Clementine didn't really want Erica there today. She hadn't missed the horrified expression that flashed across Clementine's face when she suggested she'd like to come along to hear her speak, although Clementine had quickly recovered herself and said it was fine, lovely, how nice. They could have coffee in the local food court afterwards. "It was a last-minute invitation," said Clementine. "The barbecue. We didn't know our hosts that well. They were friends of friends." She looked down at the lectern as if she'd lost her place. She'd carried a little pile of handwritten, palm-sized index cards with her when she walked up to the lectern. There was something heartbreaking about those cards, as if Clementine had remembered that little tip from their oratory lessons at school. She must have cut them up with scissors. Not her grandmother's pearl-handled ones. They'd gone missing. It was odd seeing Clementine on stage, so to speak, without her cello. She looked so conventional in her blue jeans and nice floral top. Suburban mum outfit. Clementine's legs were too short for jeans, and they looked even shorter with flat ballet shoes like she was wearing today. Well, it was just a fact. She had looked almost, even though it seemed so disloyal to use the word in relation to Clementine, frumpy when she'd walked up to the lectern. When she performed, she put her hair up and wore heels and all black. Long skirts made out of floaty material, wide enough so she could fit the cello between her knees. Seeing Clementine sit with her head bowed tenderly, passionately towards her cello, as if she were embracing it, one long tendril of hair falling just short of the strings, her arm bent at that strange geometric angle, was always so sensual, so exotic, so other to Erica. Each time she saw Clementine perform, even after all these years, Erica inevitably experienced a sensation like loss, as though she yearned for something unattainable. She'd always assumed that sensation represented something more complicated and interesting than envy, because she had no interest in playing a musical instrument. But maybe it didn't. Maybe it all came back to envy. Watching Clementine give this halting, surely pointless little speech in this little room with a view of the busy shopping centre car park instead of the hushed, soaring-ceilinged concert halls where she normally performed gave Erica the same shameful satisfaction she felt seeing a movie star in a trashy magazine without makeup. You're not that special after all. So, there were six adults there that day, said Clementine. She cleared her throat, rocked back onto her heels, and then rocked forward again. Six adults and three children. And one yappy dog, thought Erica. Yap, yap, yap. As I said, we didn't really know our hosts, but we were all having a nice time. We were enjoying ourselves. You were enjoying yourself, thought Erica. You were. She remembered how Clementine's clear, bell-like laughter rose and fell in tandem with Vid's deep chuckle. She saw people's faces slip in and out of murky shadows, their eyes like black pools, sudden flashes of teeth. They'd taken far too long that afternoon to turn on the outdoor lights in that preposterous backyard. I remember at one point we were listening to music, said Clementine. She looked down at the lectern in front of her, and then up again, as if she were seeing something on the horizon far in the distance. Her eyes were blank. She didn't look like a suburban mum now. After a Dream, by the French composer Gabriel Fauré. Naturally, she pronounced it the proper French way. It's a beautiful piece of music. It has this exquisite mournfulness to it. She stopped. Did she sense the slight shifting in seats, the discomfort in her audience? Exquisite mournfulness was not the right phrase for this audience. Too excessive. Too arty. Clementine, my love, we're too ordinary for your highbrow references to French composers. Anyway, they also played November Rain by Guns N' Roses that night. Not quite so arty. Wasn't the playing of November Rain somehow related to Tiffany's revelation? Or was that before? When exactly did Tiffany share her secret? Was that when the afternoon had turned to liquid and began to slip and slide away? We had been drinking, said Clementine, but no one was drunk. Maybe a little tipsy. Her eyes met Erica's, as though she'd been aware of exactly where she was sitting the whole time and had been avoiding looking at her, but had now made a deliberate decision to seek her out. Erica stared back and tried to smile, like a friend. Clementine's closest friend, the godmother of her children. But her face felt paralyzed, as if she'd had a stroke. Anyway, it was very late in the afternoon, and we were all about to have dessert. We were all laughing, said Clementine. She dropped Erica's gaze to look at someone else in the audience in the front row, and it felt dismissive, even cruel. Over something. I don't remember what. Erica felt lightheaded, claustrophobic. The room had become unbearably stuffy. The need to get out was suddenly overpowering. Here we go, she thought. Here we go again. Fight or flight response. Activation of her sympathetic nervous system. A shift in her brain chemicals. That's what it was. Perfectly natural. Childhood trauma. She'd read all the literature. She knew exactly what was happening to her, but the knowledge made no difference. Her body went right ahead and betrayed her. Her heart raced. Her hands trembled. She could smell her childhood, so thick and real in her nostrils, damp and mould and shame. Don't fight the panic. Face it. Float through it, her psychologist had told her. Her psychologist was exceptional, worth every cent, but for God's sake, as if you could float when there was no room, no space anywhere, above, below, when you couldn't take a step without feeling the spongy give of rotting stuff beneath your feet. She stood, pulling at her skirt, which had got stuck to the back of her legs. The guy with the barcode glanced over his shoulder at her. The sympathetic concern in his eyes gave her a tiny shock. It was like seeing the disconcertingly intelligent eyes of an ape. Sorry, whispered Erica, I have to. She pointed at her watch and shuffled sideways past him, trying not to brush the back of his head with her jacket. As she reached the back of the room, Clementine said, I remember there was a moment when my friend screamed my name, really loud. I'll never forget the sound. Erica stopped with her hand on the door, her back to the room. Clementine must have leaned towards the microphone because her voice suddenly filled the room. She shouted, Clementine! Clementine had always been an excellent mimic. As a musician, she had an ear for the precise intonations in people's voices. Erica could hear raw terror and shrill urgency in just that one word, Clementine. She knew she was the friend who had shouted Clementine's name that night, but she had no memory of it. There was nothing but a pure white space where that memory should have been. And if she couldn't remember a moment like that, well, that indicated a problem, an anomaly, a discrepancy, an extremely significant and concerning discrepancy. The wave of panic peaked and nearly swept her off her feet. She pushed down the handle of the door and staggered out into the relentless rain. Chapter 2. Been at a meeting then, said the cab driver, taking Erica back into the city. He grinned paternally at her in the rear vision mirror, as if it was kind of cute the way women worked these days, all dressed up in suits, almost like they were proper business people. Yes, said Erica. She gave her umbrella a vigorous shake on the floor of the cab. Keep your eyes on the road.
Yes, ma'am.
The cab driver tapped two fingers to his forehead in a mock salute. The rain, said Erica defensively. She indicated the raindrops pelleting furiously against the windscreen. Slippery roads.
Just drove this goose to the airport, said the cab driver.
He stopped talking as he changed lanes,
one meaty hand on the wheel, the other arm slung casually along the back of the seat, leaving Erica with the image of an actual large white goose sitting in the back seat of the taxi. He reckons all this rain is related to climate change. I said, mate, I said, it's nothing to do with climate change. It's La Niña. You know about La Niña, El Niño and La Niña. Natural events been happening for thousands of years. Right, said Erica. She wished Oliver were with her. He'd take on this conversation for her. Why were cab drivers so insistent on educating their passengers? Yep. La Niña, said the cabbie, with a sort of Mexican inflection. He obviously enjoyed saying La Niña. So we broke the record, hey? Longest consecutive run of rainy days in Sydney since 1932. Hooray for us. Yes, said Erica. Hooray for us. It was 1931. She never forgot a number, but there was no need to correct him. I think you'll find it was 1931, she said. She couldn't help herself. It was a character flaw. She knew it. Yeah, that's it, 1931, said the cabbie, as if that's what he'd said in the first place. Before that, it was 24 days in 1893. 24 rainy days in a row. Let's hope we don't break that record too, eh? Think we will? Let's hope not, said Erica. She ran a finger along her forehead. Was that sweat or rain? She'd calmed down as she waited in the rain outside the library for the cab. Her breathing was steady again, but her stomach still rocked and roiled, and she felt exhausted, depleted, as if she'd run a marathon. She took out her phone and texted Clementine. Sorry, had to rush off. Problem at work. You were fantastic. Talk later. E. Kiss. She changed fantastic to great. Fantastic was over the top, also inaccurate. She pressed send. It had been an error of judgment to take precious time out of her working day to come and listen to Clementine's talk. She'd only gone to be supportive, and because she wanted to get her own feelings about what had happened filed away in an orderly fashion. It was as though her memory of that afternoon was a strip of old-fashioned film, and someone had taken a pair of scissors and removed certain frames. They weren't even whole frames. They were slivers, thin slivers of time. She just wanted to fill in those slivers without admitting to anyone, I don't quite remember it all. An image came to her of her own face reflected in her bathroom mirror, her hands shaking violently as she tried to break that little yellow pill in half with her thumbnail. She suspected the gaps in her memory were related to the tablet she'd taken that afternoon. But it was a prescription pill. It wasn't like she'd popped an ecstasy tablet before going to a barbecue. She remembered feeling odd, a little detached, before they went next door to the barbecue, but that still didn't account for the gaps. Too much to drink? Yes. Too much to drink. Face the facts, Erica. You were affected by alcohol. You were drunk. Erica couldn't quite believe that word could apply to her, but it seemed to be the case. She had been unequivocally drunk for the first time in her life. So maybe the gaps were alcoholic blackouts. Like Oliver's mum and dad. They can't remember whole decades of their life, Oliver said once in front of his parents. And they'd both laughed delightedly and raised their glasses, even though Oliver wasn't smiling. So what do you do for a quid, if you don't mind me asking? Said the cabbie. I'm an accountant, said Erica. Ah, you know, said the cabbie with far too much interest. What a coincidence, because I was just thinking. Erica's phone rang, and she startled, as she did without fail, whenever her phone rang. It's a phone, Erica, Oliver kept telling her. That's what it's meant to do. She could see it was her mother, the very last person in the world she wanted to talk to right now, but the cab driver was shifting in his seat, his eyes on her instead of the road, virtually licking his lips in anticipation of all the free tax advice he was about to get. Cab drivers knew a little bit about everything. He'd want to tell her about an amazing loophole he'd heard about from one of his regular customers. Erica wasn't that kind of accountant. Loophole was not a word she appreciated. Maybe her mother was the lesser of two evils. Hello, Mum.
Well, hello. I didn't expect you to answer.
Her mother sounded both nervous and defiant, which didn't bode well at all.
I was all prepared to leave a voicemail message, said Sylvia accusingly.
Sorry I answered, said Erica. She was sorry.
Obviously, you don't need to be sorry. I just need to recalibrate. Tell you what, why don't you just listen while I pretend to leave you the message I had all prepared?
Go ahead, said Erica. She looked out at the rainy street, where a woman battled with an umbrella that wanted to turn itself inside out. Erica watched as the woman suddenly, marvellously lost her temper and jammed the umbrella into a rubbish bin without losing stride and continued walking in the rain.
Good on you, thought Erica, exhilarated by this little tableau. Just throw it out. Throw the damned thing out.
Her mother's voice got louder in her ear as if she'd repositioned her phone.
I was going to start like this. Erica, darling, I was going to say. Erica, darling, I know you can't talk right now because you're at work, which is such a pity, being stuck in an office on this beautiful day. Not that it is a beautiful day, I must admit. It's actually a terrible day, a horrendous day. But normally, this time of year, we have such glorious days. And whenever I wake up and have a peek outside at the blue sky, I think, oh dear, what a pity. Poor, poor old Erica, stuck in her office on this beautiful day. That's what I think. But that's the price you pay for corporate success. If only you'd been a park ranger or some other outdoorsy job. I wasn't actually going to say the park ranger part. That just came to me then. And actually, I know why it came to me, because Sally's son has just left school and he's going to be a park ranger. And when she was telling me, I just thought to myself, you know, what a marvellous job. What a clever idea, instead of being trapped in a little cubicle like you are.
I'm not trapped in a cubicle, sighed Erica. Her office had harbour views and fresh flowers bought each Monday morning by her secretary. She loved her office. She loved her job. It was Sally's idea, you know, for her son to be a park ranger. So clever of her. She's not conventional, Sally. She thinks outside the box.
Sally, said Erica. Sally, my new hairdresser, said her mother impatiently, as if Sally had been in her life for years, not a couple of months, as if Sally were going to be a lifelong friend. Huh. Sally would go the way of all the other wonderful strangers in her mother's life.
So what else was your message going to say? Said Erica.
Let's see now. Then I was going to say, sort of casually, as if I'd only just thought of it, oh, listen, darling, by the way.
Erica laughed. Her mother could always charm her, even at the worst times. Just when Erica thought she was done, that was it, she could take no more, her mother charmed her back into loving her. Her mother laughed too, but it sounded hectic and high-pitched.
I was gonna say, Listen, darling, I was wondering if you and Oliver would like to come to lunch at my place on Sunday.
No, said Erica. No.
She breathed in like she was breathing in through a straw. Her lips felt wonky.
No, thank you. We'll be at your place on the 15th.
That's when we'll come, Mum.
No other time.
That's the deal.
But darling, I think you'd be so proud of me because...
No, said Erica. I'll meet you anywhere else. We can go out to lunch this Sunday to a nice restaurant. Or you can come to our place. Oliver and I don't have anything on. We can go anywhere else, but we are not coming to your house.
She paused and said it again, louder and more clearly, as if she was speaking to someone without a good grasp of English.
We are not coming to your house.
There was silence.
Until the 15th, said Erica. It's in the diary. It's in both our diaries. And don't forget we've got that dinner with Clementine's parents on Thursday night. So we've got that to look forward to as well.
Yes, indeed, that was going to be a barrel of laughs.
I had a new recipe I wanted to try. I bought a gluten-free recipe book, did I tell you?
It was the flip tone that did it. The calculated, cruel brightness. As if she thought there was a chance Erica might join her in playing the game they'd played all those years, where they both pretended to be an ordinary mother and daughter having an ordinary conversation. When she knew that Erica no longer played. When they'd both agreed the game was over. When her mother had wept and apologized and made promises they both knew she'd never keep. But now she wanted to pretend she'd never even made the promises in the first place.
Mum, dear God.
What?
Faux innocence. That infuriating babyish voice.
You promised on Grandma's grave that you wouldn't buy another recipe book. You don't cook. You don't have a gluten allergy.
Why did her voice tremble with rage when she never expected those melodramatic promises to be kept?
I made no such promise, said her mother,
and she dropped the baby voice and had the audacity to respond to Erica's rage with her own.
And as a matter of fact, I have been suffering quite dreadful bloating lately. I have gluten intolerance, thank you very much. Excuse me for worrying about my health.
Do not engage. Remove yourself from the emotional minefield. This was why she was investing thousands of dollars in therapy for exactly this situation.
All right then. Well, Mum, it was nice talking to you, said Erica rapidly, without giving her mother a chance to speak, as if she were a telemarketer. But I'm at work, so I have to go now. I'll talk to you later.
She hung up before her mother could speak and dropped the phone in her lap. The cab driver's shoulders were conspicuously still against his beaded seat cover, only his hands moving on the bottom of the steering wheel, pretending that he hadn't been listening in.
What sort of daughter refuses to go to her mother's house?
What sort of daughter speaks with such ferocity to her mother about buying a new recipe book? She blinked, hard. Her phone rang again, and she jumped so violently it nearly slid off her lap. It would be her mother again, ringing to shout abuse. But it wasn't her mother. It was Oliver.
Hi,
she said, and nearly cried with relief at the sound of his voice.
Just had a fun phone call with Mum. She wanted us to go over for lunch on Sunday.
We're not due there until next month, are we? Said Oliver. No, said Erica. She was pushing her boundaries.
Are you okay?
Yep. She ran a fingertip under her eyes. Fine.
You sure?
Yes. Thank you.
Just put her straight out of your mind, said Oliver. Hey, did you go to Clementine's talk at that library? Out in wherever it was?
Erica tipped back her head against the seat and closed her eyes.
Damn it. Of course, that's why he was calling. Clementine. The plan had been that she would chat to Clementine after her talk, while they had coffee. Oliver had not been overly interested in Erica's motivation for attending Clementine's talk. He didn't understand her obsessive desire to fill in the blank spots of her memory. He found it irrelevant, almost silly.
Believe me, you've remembered everything you're ever going to remember, he'd said. His lips went thin, his eyes hard on the words, believe me. Just a little flash of pain he could never quite repress, and that he would probably deny feeling. Blank spots are par for the course when you drink too much.
They weren't par for her course. But Oliver had seen this as the perfect opportunity to talk to Clementine, to finally pin her down. She should have let him go to voicemail too.
I did, she said, but I left halfway through. I didn't feel well.
So you didn't get to talk to Clementine? Said Oliver.
She could hear him doing his best to conceal his frustration.
Not today, she said. Don't worry, I'm just finding the right time. The food court wouldn't have been the best spot anyway.
I'm just looking at my diary. It has been 2 months now since the barbecue. I don't think it's offensive or insensitive or whatever to just ask a question. Just ring her up. It doesn't need to be face to face.
I know. I'm sorry.
You don't need to be sorry, said Oliver. This is difficult. It's not your fault.
It was my fault we went to the barbecue in the first place, she said.
Oliver wouldn't absolve her of that. He was too accurate. They'd always had that in common, a passion for accuracy.
The cabbie slammed on his brake. You bloody idiot driver! You bloody goose!
Erica put her hand flat against the front seat to brace herself as Oliver said, That's not relevant.
It's relevant to me, she said.
Her phone beeped to let her know another call was coming through. It would be her mother. The fact that it had taken her a couple of minutes to call back meant that she had chosen tears over abuse. Tears took longer.
I don't know what you want me to say about that, Erica, said Oliver worriedly.
He thought there was an actual correct response, an answer at the back of the book. He thought there was a secret set of relationship rules that she must know because she was the woman and she was deliberately withholding them.
Just, will you talk to Clementine? He said.
I'll talk to Clementine, said Erica.
See you tonight.
She turned her phone to silent and put it in her bag, at her feet. The taxi driver turned up the radio. He must have given up on asking her accounting advice now, probably thinking that judging from her personal life, her professional advice couldn't be trusted. Erica thought of Clementine, who would be finishing up her little speech at the library by now, presumably to polite applause from her audience. There would be no bravos, no standing ovations, no bouquets backstage. Poor Clementine,
feeling she had to virtually abase herself in this way. Oliver was right. The decision to go to the barbecue was of no relevance. It was a sunk cost. She put her head back against the seat, closed her eyes, and remembered a silver car driving towards her, surrounded by a swirling funnel of autumn leaves. Chapter 3. The Day of the Barbecue. Erica drove into her cul-de-sac and was greeted by a strange, almost beautiful sight. Someone was finally driving the silver BMW that had been parked outside the Richardsons' house for the last 6 months, and whoever was driving hadn't bothered to brush away the layer of red and gold autumn leaves that had accumulated on the car's bonnet and roof, so that as they drove, much too fast for a residential area, a whirling vortex of leaves was created, as if the car were being followed by a mini tornado. As the leaves cleared, Erica saw her next-door neighbour, Vid, standing at the end of his driveway, watching the car drive away while a single ray of sunlight bounced off his sunglasses, like the shimmer of a camera flash. Erica braked next to him, opening her passenger side window at the same time. "Good morning," she called out. "Somebody finally moved that car."
"Yes, they must have finished their drug dealing. What do you reckon?"
Vid leaned down towards the car, pushing his sunglasses up onto his head of luxuriant grey hair.
"Or maybe it was the mafia, you know."
"Ha ha," Erica laughed unconvincingly, because Vid looked kind of like a successful gangster himself.
"It's a cracker of a day, you know? Look, am I right?"
Vid made a satisfied gesture at the sky, as if he'd personally purchased the day and paid a premium price for it and got the quality product he deserved.
"It is a beautiful day," said Erica. "You off for a walk?"
Vid reacted with faint disgust to this suggestion.
"Walk? Me? No."
He indicated a lit cigarette between his fingers and the rolled-up, plastic-wrapped Sunday paper in the other hand.
"I just came down to collect my paper, you know."
Erica reminded herself not to count the number of times Vid said, "you know." Recording someone's conversational tick bordered on obsessive-compulsive. Vid's current record, 11 times in a 2-minute diatribe about the removal of the smoked pancetta pizza from the local pizzeria's menu. Vid could not believe it. He just could not believe it. You know? The you knows came thick and fast when he got excited. Erica was very aware that some of her behaviours could potentially be classified as obsessive-compulsive.
"I wouldn't get too caught up with labels, Erica," her psychologist had said, with the constipated smile she tended to give when Erica self-diagnosed.
Erica had taken out a subscription to Psychology Today when she started therapy, just to educate herself a little about the process, and it was also fascinating. She'd recently begun working her way through the first-year reading list for a psychological and behavioural sciences undergraduate degree at Cambridge. "Just for interest," she told her psychologist, who didn't look threatened by this, but didn't look exactly thrilled by it either.
"Bloody rev-head kid hoons up the street and throws it from his car like he's throwing a grenade in bloody Syria, you know?"
Vid made a grenade-throwing gesture with the rolled-up paper.
"So, what are you up to? Been grocery shopping?"
He looked at the little collection of plastic bags on Erica's passenger seat and drew deeply on his cigarette, blowing a stream of smoke out the side of his mouth.
"Not exactly grocery shopping, just some, bits and bobs I needed." "Bits and bobs," repeated Vid, trying out the phrase
as if he'd never heard it before. Maybe he hadn't. He looked at Erica in that searching, almost disappointed way he had, as if he'd been hoping for something more from her. Yes, for afternoon tea. We've got Clementine and Sam coming over later for afternoon tea with their little girls. My friends? Clementine and Sam? You met them at my place? She knew perfectly well that Vid remembered them. She was giving him Clementine to make herself more interesting. That's all she had to offer Vid. Clementine. Vid's face lit up instantly. You're a friend, the cellist, said Vid delightedly. He virtually smacked his lips on the word cellist. And her husband, tone deaf. What a waste, eh? Well, he likes to say he's tone deaf, said Erica. I think technically he's top bloke. He was a, what you call it, a marketing manager for an FMCG company, and that stands for a fast-moving, fast-moving consumer good. Whatever the hell that means. But how's that? Good memory, eh? I've got a mind like a steel trap. That's what I tell my wife. Well, he's actually changed jobs. Now he's at an energy drink company. What? Energy drinks. Drinks that give you energy. Anyway, Sam and Clementine, they're good people. Great people, you know? You should all come over to our place. For a barbecue, you know? Yes. We'll do a barbecue. Enjoy this amazing weather. You know, I insist. You must. Oh, said Erica. It's nice of you to offer. She should say no. She was perfectly capable of saying no. She had no problem saying no to people. In fact, she took pride in her ability to refuse. And Oliver wouldn't want her to change the plans for today. It was too important. Today was crucial. Today was potentially life-changing. I'll roast a pig on the spit, the Slovenian way. Well, it's not really the Slovenian way. It's my way. But it's like nothing you've ever tasted before. Your friend, Clementine. I remember, she's a foodie, you know, like me. He patted his stomach. Well, said Erica. She looked again at the plastic bags on her passenger seat. All the way home from the shops, she'd kept glancing over at her purchases, worried that she'd somehow not got it quite right. She should have bought more. What was wrong with her? Why hadn't she bought a feast? Also, the crackers she'd chosen had sesame seeds on them, and there was some significance to sesame seeds. Did Clementine love sesame seeds or hate them? What do you say? Said Vid. Tiffany would love to see you. Would she? Said Erica. Most wives wouldn't appreciate an unplanned barbecue. But Vid's wife did appear to be almost as sociable as Vid. Erica thought of the first time she'd introduced her closest friends to her extroverted next-door neighbours, when she and Oliver hosted Christmas drinks at their place last year in a fit of mutual, let's pretend we're the sort of people who entertain and enjoy it, madness. She and Oliver had both hated every moment. Entertaining was always fraught for Erica because she had no experience of it and because part of her would always believe that visitors were to be feared and despised. And they've got two little girls, right? Continued Vid. Our Dakota would love to play with them. Yes, Although, remember, they're much younger than Dakota. Even better. Dakota loves playing with little girls, you know, pretending she's the big sister, you know, plaiting their hair, painting their nails, you know, fun for all of them.
Erica ran her hands around the steering wheel. She looked at her house. The low hedge lining the path to the front door was freshly trimmed with perfect, startling symmetry. The blinds were open. The windows were clean and streak-free. Nothing to hide. From the street, you could see their red Veronese table lamp. That's all. Only the lamp. An exquisite lamp. Just seeing that lamp from the street when she drove home gave Erica a sense of pride and peace. Oliver was inside now, vacuuming. Erica had vacuumed yesterday, so it was overkill. Excessive vacuuming. Embarrassing. When Erica first left home, one of the many procedural things that worried her about domestic life was trying to work out how often normal people vacuumed. It was Clementine's mother who'd given her a definitive answer. Once a week, Erica. Every Sunday afternoon, for example. You pick a regular time that suits you. Make it a habit. Erica had religiously followed Pam's rules for living, whereas Clementine willfully ignored them.
"Sam and I always forget that vacuuming is even a thing," she'd once told Erica. "We always feel better, though, once it's done, and then we say, let's vacuum more often. It's kind of like when we remember to have sex."
Erica had been astonished, both by the vacuuming and the sex. She knew that she and Oliver were more formal with each other in public than other couples. They didn't really tease each other. They liked things to be clear, not open to misinterpretation. But, gosh, they'd never forget to have sex. A vacuumed house wasn't going to make a difference to the outcome of today's meeting any more than sesame seeds were.
"Pig on the spit, eh?" said Erica to Vid.
She put her head on one side, coquettishly, the way Clementine would in a situation like this. She sometimes borrowed Clementine's mannerisms for herself, although only when Clementine wasn't there, in case they were recognised.
"You mean to say you've got a spare pig just lying around waiting to be roasted?"
Vid grinned, pleased with her, winked and pointed his cigarette at her. The smoke drifted into the car, bringing in another world.
"Don't you worry about that, Erica."
He put the emphasis on the second syllable, Erica. It made her name sound more exotic.
"We'll get it all sorted, you know. What time is your cellist friend coming over?"
2? 3?
3, said Erica. She was already regretting the coquettishness. Oh, God. What had she done? She looked past Vid and saw Harry, the old man who lived alone on the other side of Vid, in his front yard, standing next to his camellia bush with a pair of garden shears. Their eyes met, and she raised her hand to wave, but he immediately looked away and wandered off out of sight into the corner of the garden.
"Our mate, Harry, lurking about?" said Vid, without turning around.
"Yes," said Erica. "He's gone now."
"So, 3 o'clock then," said Vid.
He gave the side of her car a decisive rap with his knuckles.
"We see you then."
"All right," said Erica weakly. She watched Oliver open their front door and step onto the front porch with a bag of rubbish. He was going to be furious with her.
"Perfect! Outstanding!"
Vid straightened from the car and caught sight of Oliver, who smiled and waved.
"Mate!" bellowed Vid. "We'll see you later today. Barbecue at our place. Oliver's smile disappeared.
Chapter 4. Clementine drove out of the library car park in a mild panic, one hand on the steering wheel, the other fiddling with her demister, because her windscreen had suddenly, cruelly, fogged over so that it was virtually opaque in places. She was 20 minutes later leaving than she'd planned to be. After she finished her talk, to the usual hesitant, muted applause, as if people weren't sure if it was quite appropriate to clap, she'd kept getting caught in conversation as she tried to reach the door. So close, but yet so far. Through the small but impenetrable group of people now tucking into their complimentary, homemade morning tea. One woman wanted to hug her and pat her cheek. A man, who she later noticed had a barcode tattooed on the back of his neck, was keen to hear her thoughts on the council plans for the swimming pool redevelopment and didn't seem to believe her when she said she wasn't local and therefore really couldn't comment. A tiny white-haired lady wanted her to try a piece of carrot cake wrapped in a pink paper napkin. She ate the carrot cake. It was very good carrot cake. So there was that. The windscreen cleared like a small gift, and she turned left out of the car park, because left was always her default turn when she had no idea where she was going. "Start talking," she said to her GPS. "You've got one job. Do it." She needed the GPS to direct her home fast so she could pick up her cello before rushing over to her friend Ainsley's place, where she was going to play her pieces in front of Ainsley and her husband, Hugh. The audition was in 2 weeks' time. "So you're still going for this job," her mother had said last week, in a tone of surprise and possibly judgment, but Clementine heard judgment everywhere these days, so she might have imagined it. "Yes, I'm still going to audition," she'd said coldly, and her mother had said nothing further. She drove slowly, waiting for instructions, but her GPS was silent, mulling things over. "Are you going to tell me where to go?" she asked it. Apparently not. She got to a set of lights and turned left. She couldn't just keep turning left, because otherwise she'd be turning in a circle. Wouldn't she? Once, she would have gone home and told Sam about this, and he would have laughed and teased and sympathized and offered to buy her a new GPS. "I hate you," Clementine told the silent GPS. "I hate and despise you." The GPS ignored her, and Clementine peered out the window through the rain, looking for a sign. She could feel the beginnings of a headache, because she was frowning so hard. She shouldn't be here, driving all the way to the other side of Sydney in the rain, in this flat, grey, unfamiliar suburb. She should have been at home, practicing. That's what she would have been doing. Wherever she went, whatever she did, part of her mind was always imagining a hypothetical life running parallel to her actual one. A life where, when Erica rang up and said, "Vid has invited us to a barbecue," Clementine answered, "No, thank you." Three simple words. Vid wouldn't have cared. He barely knew them. It was not Vid at the symphony last night. It was her mind playing cruel tricks, placing that big head smack bang in the middle of a sea of faces. At least she'd been prepared to see Erica today in the audience, although her stomach had still lurched when she'd first caught sight of her, sitting so rigidly in the back row like she was at a funeral, a flicker of a smile when she caught Clementine's eye. Why had she asked to come? It was weird. Did she think it was like seeing Clementine perform?
Even if she did think that, it was still out of character for Erica to take time out of her workday to drive all the way out here from North Sydney to hear Clementine share a story she already knew. And then she'd got up and left halfway through. She'd texted to say there was a problem at work, but that seemed unlikely. Surely there was no accounting problem that couldn't wait 20 minutes. It had been a relief when she left. It had been disconcerting trying to speak with that small, intense face pulling her attention like a magnet. At one point, the irrelevant, distracting thought had crossed her mind that Erica's fair hair was cut in an identical style to Clementine's mother's. A no-nonsense, symmetrical, shoulder-length style with a long fringe cut dead straight just above the eyebrows. Erica idolized Clementine's mother. It was either a deliberate or a subconscious imitation, but surely not a coincidence. She saw a sign pointing towards the city and quickly changed lanes just as the GPS woke up and directed her to the "turn right ahead" in a plummy female English accent. "Yes, I worked it out myself, thanks anyway," she said. The rain started again, and she flicked on the wipers. A piece of rubber on one of the wipers had made its way free, and on every third swipe it made a high-pitched screech, like a door slowly opening in a horror movie. "Screech!" 2, 3. "Screech!" 2, 3. It made her think of zombies in a lumbering waltz. She would call Erica today, or tomorrow morning. Erica was owed an answer. Enough time had passed. There was only one answer, of course, but Clementine had been waiting for the appropriate time. Don't think about that now. Think only about the audition. She needed to compartmentalize, as the Facebook articles suggested. Men were supposedly good at compartmentalizing. They gave their full attention to whatever they were doing, although, in fact, Sam had never had a problem multitasking. He could make a risotto while unpacking the dishwasher and simultaneously playing some good-for-their-brains game with the girls. Clementine was the one who wandered off, picked up her cello, and then forgot she had something in the oven. She was the one who had once, mortifyingly, forgotten to pick Holly up from a birthday party. Something Sam would never do. "Your mother walks around in a permanent daze," Sam used to say to the girls, but he said it fondly, or she thought he had. Maybe she'd imagined the fondness. She could no longer be sure what anyone truly thought of her. Her mother, her husband, her friend. Anything seemed possible. She thought again of her mother's comment, "So, you're still going for this job?" She'd never put in this many practice hours for an audition, even before the children were born. All that self-indulgent whining she used to do. "I'm a working mother with two small children. Woe is me. There just aren't enough hours in my day." In fact, there were plenty more hours in the day if you just slept less. Now she went to bed at midnight instead of 10 p.m. and got up at 5 instead of 7. Living on less sleep gave her a not unpleasant, mildly sedated feeling. She felt detached from all aspects of her life. She had no time anymore to feel. All that time she used to waste feeling and analysing her feelings as if they were a matter of national significance. Clementine feels extremely nervous about her upcoming audition. Clementine doesn't know she's good enough. Well, hooly-dooly, stop the presses. Let's research audition nerves. Let's talk earnestly with musician friends. Let's get constant reassurance. Stop it. The endless self-mockery of the person she used to be was not especially productive either.
Spend your time focusing on questions of technique. She searched her mind for a distracting technical problem. For example, the fingering for the opening arpeggio of the Beethoven. She kept changing her mind. The trickier option could pay off with a better musical result, but the risk was that she'd make a mistake when she was under pressure. Was that a traffic jam ahead? She must not be late. Her friends were giving up their time to do this for her. There was nothing in it for them. Pure altruism. She looked at the stopped traffic, and once again she was in Tiffany's car, trapped in a sea of red brake lights, the seatbelt like a restraint pulled tight against her neck. The traffic kept moving. It was fine. She heard herself exhale, although she hadn't been aware she was holding her breath. She would ask Sam tonight when they were out for dinner if his mind kept getting stuck in the same pointless what-if groove as hers. Maybe it would open up a conversation, a healing conversation. That was the sort of phrase her mother would use. They were going out tonight on a date night, another modern term her mother had picked up. What you kids need is a date night. She and Sam both abhorred the term date night, but they were going on one, to a restaurant suggested by Clementine's mother. Her mother was babysitting and had even made the booking. Forgiveness is the attribute of the strong. I think it was Gandhi who said that, her mother told her. Her mother's refrigerator door was covered with inspirational quotes scrawled on little pieces of paper held up by fridge magnets. The fridge magnets had quotes on them too. Maybe tonight would be okay. Maybe it would even be fun. She was trying to be positive. One of them had to be. Her car drifted close to the gutter, and a gigantic wave of water whooshed up the side of her car. She swore, far more viciously than was warranted. It felt like it had been raining ever since the day of the barbecue, although she knew this wasn't true. When she thought of her life before the barbecue, it was suffused with golden sunlight, blue skies, soft breezes, as if it had never rained before. Turn left ahead, said the GPS. What, here? Said Clementine. Are you sure? Or do you mean the next one? I think you mean the next one. She kept driving. Turn around when possible, said the GPS, with the hint of a sigh. Sorry, said Clementine humbly. Chapter 5. The Day of the Barbecue. Sunlight flooded the kitchen where Clementine ran on the spot in her pyjamas while her husband Sam yelled, Sergeant Major style, Run, soldier, run! Her two-year-old daughter, Ruby, also in her pyjamas, her hair a tangled blonde bird's nest, ran alongside Clementine, bobbing about like a puppet on a string, and giggling. She had a soft, soggy piece of croissant clamped in one pudgy hand and a metal whisk with a wooden handle in the other, although nobody thought of whisk as merely a kitchen utensil anymore. Whisk was fed, bathed, and put tenderly to bed each night by Ruby in his/her, Whisk's gender was fluid, tissue paper-lined shoebox. Why am I running? Panted Clementine. I don't like running. This morning, Sam had announced, with an evangelical look in his eye, that he'd developed a foolproof plan to help her nail this audition, baby. He'd been up late last night getting his plan ready. First, she needed to run on the spot for 5 minutes as fast as she could. Don't ask questions, just follow orders, said Sam. Lift those knees. You've got to be puffing.
Clementine tried to lift her knees. He must have Googled tips for your orchestral audition. And tip number one was something delightfully trite, like exercise. Make sure you're in peak physical condition. This was the problem with being married to a non-musician. A musician would have known that the way to help her prepare for her audition was by taking the girls out this morning so she had time to practice before they had to go over to Erica's place. It's not rocket science, soldier. 2 minutes more. Sam studied her. He was unshaven, in his t-shirt and boxers. Actually, you might only need 1 minute more. You're not very fit. I'm stopping, said Clementine, slowing to a jog. No, you mustn't stop. It's to stimulate your audition nerves by making your heart rate go up. Once it's up, you have to launch straight into playing your excerpts. What? No, I'm not going to play now. She needed to spend time meticulously preparing her excerpts. I want another coffee. Run, soldier, run, shouted Sam. Oh, for God's sake. She kept running. It wouldn't hurt her to do some exercise, although actually it was already hurting quite a lot. Their five-year-old and three-quarters, it was important to clarify, daughter, Holly, clip-clopped into the living room wearing her pyjama pants, an old ripped frozen dress and a pair of Clementine's high heels. She put her hand on her jutted hip as though she was on the red carpet and waited to be admired. Wow, look at Holly, said Sam dutifully. Take those shoes off before you hurt yourself. Why are you both running? Said Holly to her mother and her sister. She hooked her fingers in the air to make exaggerated inverted commas on the word running. It was a new sophisticated habit of hers, except she thought you could just pick any word at random and give it inverted commas. The more words, the better. She frowned. Stop that! Your father is making me run, gasped Clementine. Ruby had suddenly had enough of running and plopped down on her bottom. She carefully laid her piece of croissant on the floor for later and sucked hard on her thumb, like a smoker in need of a drag. Daddy, stop making Mummy run, demanded Holly. She's breathing funny.